Good morning, everybody. My name is Kathy Shires, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is January 4th of 2007. That was not my original sobriety date. I've had to, some people write them in their big book. I've had to mark and erase and change it a couple times. My home group is the Fifth Tradition Group in Atlanta, Georgia. We have a book study at 8 o'clock on Thursday nights, and we have a speaker meeting on Saturdays at 7, and we'd love to have you guys come down one evening. We bring in speakers like Don, who's coming in next month to do a workshop and speak at our home group, and it's certainly the best home group for me. You know, we are a purposeful group of people in action, very busy group, which is, the only kind of home group I can really be involved in and do well. You know, one of the truths about me, it seems, is I'm kind of a sponge. I tend to take on the culture, even the accent. I'm from Cartersville. If I'm around my family for too long, I start talking with a little bit of twang. And so if I'm around, you know, some AA groups that I frequented and were involved with early in sobriety that, you know, they're kind of, they just have a meeting and people show up, and I'm sure somebody makes the coffee or whatever, but they're not real active in service. They're nice people, but I start thinking, you know, am I going to go to the meeting? Because there's a really good TV show on, and I kind of really want to finish binge watching that show I was doing. There's never a question with the people in my home group of whether or not you're going to be there. You're going to be there. It's more like, where were you if you weren't, you know? And that's kind of the best kind of home group for me. I really appreciate the committee for asking me to be here. My husband was a speaker on Sunday 2 years ago, and it was lovely being here and meeting you guys. I've really enjoyed the conference all weekend. I broke my neck to get here through the traffic and the rain on Friday, thankfully, to hear Tim, who was delightful. And Don is one of my heroes. He said he might be leaving today, and last night he said, you know, I might be having to go back, I might have to miss you, and I kind of thought, that's good, because you know, I might feel like I need to be really impressive, because you're one of my heroes, you know what I mean? Now I see him sitting there, and I'm like, oh, geez. And I unfortunately didn't get a chance to hear Angie or the four-step workshop yesterday, because my oldest child, my son, just started college. We had to move him in yesterday. So it was a really big day for all of us, and so my husband and I rode down to Macon to get him into Mercer and get him all settled and then run back up here, and so I really look forward to listening to you guys and on the CD. What strikes me when I listen to people like Tim and Don and, you know, having a lot of sobriety that I really respect and revere, I go, what in the world am I doing up here? Because I'm telling you what, they should have the poster out there that has a big red circle and a line through it, like what not to do in AA. That's who you got standing here. If there's a mistake to be made in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've done it. And I can't even use the excuse of, well, I was new. I'm in and out, you know. I'm the idiot that has relapsed with 4 years of sobriety, with 10 years of sobriety. In fact, the one with 10 years, I still picked up two chips afterwards and was pretending to be sober and wasn't. So I understand the ego. I understand the line, the book, in the fifth step where it talks about, more than most people, alcoholics live a double life. I've been doing it my whole life. I do it really well. And I'm not one of those people, I have sponsees that, my God, I can see through their lies in 2 seconds. You know, they are just not good at it. I am excellent at it. I would have been an excellent, like, con artist, grifter, you know, always playing a game, always trying to stay one step ahead of you, and could lie to your face and you'd never know. That time when I was coming to AA meetings and not sober, I was married to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was sponsoring people, taking them through the big book, speaking from podiums, and was high as a kite the whole time. That is not one of my shining moments, I promise you. That is not something I'm thrilled to have to report. And it's taken a long time over this last 9 years to get over, you know, the ego deflation of what you've done. Because you kind of feel like a person who's taken from you, taken from AA, the place that I loved, and spit in God's face. You know, it's one thing to do that in you know, have not worked a program, and I have that experience, and that's understandable. But to be a person who was very involved in AA, who was a student of the Big Book and helping others find God, and yet, you know, you're still getting relief and living that truly split personality. It kind of makes sense. When I checked in on Friday and got my badge, you know, all the speakers had the great speaker thing. Mine's blank. So clearly I need to be taught something of humility. And then as I looked, it was like, I've got two voice things that have been glued together. So it's very fitting because, you know, split personality, double life. Here it is. That's perfect. And Don said, you only have two voices? I got multiple ones going on. It's like a whole committee come together. You know, I love that little Disney film, Inside Out. Like, I totally get all these different personalities, and they're all talking at the same time. I totally get it, and that is my ego up and down. It would never have been my life's goal to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and speaking to you on a Sunday morning. I grew up in alcoholism, and I would easily qualify for multiple 12-step programs. I did not see the fun side of drinking. I was not like some of my friends who saw their, you know, the parents, the adults, and they were all in the room doing the adult things, and it looked really fun. They were having a good time. I saw the horrors of alcoholism. I thought for sure I would never drink, never smoke, never do all those things because my mother, some of you may have heard Polly's story about being the person who drank a lot and took a lot of things like Seconal, Tuinol, and tranquilizers and laid on the couch. That's exactly how my mother was. When she tells a story about her son James, she was passed out on the floor, and he just marches over her and goes and makes breakfast, and that was a regular occurrence for me. I got myself dressed, I got myself to school, I did my thing, mostly didn't want to be seen or heard. You know, there was violence in my house all the time. You never knew when it was coming either. And, I spent the night sometimes with friends and knew that other families weren't like this. And so I knew that I was really abnormal, you know, that my life was abnormal, but that I was. And one of the greatest gifts of Alcoholics Anonymous is to understand that I'm not normal. I'm just like you people. But I can easily, on a bad spiritual hair day, I am really aware of how I'm not like those people. And the truth is I don't really care about being like them, really. I mean, we get along. I have friends that are non-alcoholics. It's all fine. But I don't think like them. I've always been the person that laughs when you should cry, maybe cry when you should laugh, and I got a sick sense of humor. And they don't get it because they're just like, that's horrible. How would you make fun of that? Well, anything's worth making fun of, as far as I'm concerned. Anything's game. And thankfully, in AA, I found my people. You know, like the mothership coming to take you home, as Tim was talking about. Like, I get that. I found my people, my place in AA. I mean, I fell in love with AA pretty early on because you guys were my kind of people. And I thankfully have friends today that seem to love and accept me for the crazy and fairly insane person that I am, offbeat and marching totally to the beat of a different drummer, and it's okay. I don't have to pretend to be a pretend person anymore and pretend to be normal and pretend to be something I'm not. It's exhausting, and it's not a lot of fun. But, you know, as a kid, I didn't want to bring people home, and I very early on learned how to play a double life. You know, and the violence was going on in the house, and I would just lock myself in my room and turn the music up and sing Olivia Newton-John, and I knew I was going to be famous one day. I wasn't going to have to do anything, work at it. I was just going to walk down the street one day, and somebody's going to say, "You'd be perfect for this movie," and, you know, talk about grandiosity. And I didn't know that I had that kind of egomania, because what it seems like I felt most of the time was just knowing that I don't measure up to people. You know, I just had that self-centered fear that I didn't get the memo that day. You know, just off a little bit. So I become a quick study of people, and then I can bring out whichever, you know, person you want. If I was in a lot of smart classes, the gifted classes, and so I could be kind of the nerdier kind of girl, whatever. I clearly like the really offbeat people, so I could bring out that personality. If anybody loved or liked me, they really liked or loved a figment of my imagination. It was whatever I thought you wanted me to be, is what I brought out. I'm a bundle of nerves. I know I'm not normal. I don't know how to behave. I don't know what's going on half the time. And the bumps and the scrapes through life of being embarrassed or somebody making fun of your last name, that stuff ripped through me. I'm sure it was awful for everybody, but it was like crippling to me. And so I would withdraw from people, you know. And then I discovered alcohol, you know. And I was 15 years old. And at 13, my mother died of alcoholism when I was 39. You cannot smoke 3 packs of cigarettes a day and take those kind of pills that you're taking, the ones that are no longer on the market, they're so bad, and drink copious amounts of booze and expect to live. You know, and I mean, this is a woman who had multiple consequences, 8 DUIs, hit a pedestrian, never lost her license. Yay for the 1970s, right? And 5 days before she keeled over from a heart attack, my dad said, "Girl, you're going to die." And she said, "I can handle it." Isn't it amazing? The delusion that Don talked about. But that was what the picture of an alcoholic I had. That was the only definition. You know, it didn't have to be the person that lived in the park and drinking the booze out of a paper bag or whatever. It was my mother, right? So when I started drinking, it was just kind of one of those fun times. We were away in Florida, and we talked my aunt to buying us some booze because we thought, here's 4 teenagers, we're going to drink and see what that's all about. And she said, okay, fine, as long as you stay in the condo. By the end of the night, we're shouting obscenities off the balcony, throwing things at the people at the pool. Somebody's throwing up in the bathroom. She's pouring the booze down, wishing she'd never done this. And it was singly the best night I've ever had in my life. You know, I don't know what happened to the other 3 people we were drinking, but I know what happened to me. And finally, I found out what was wrong with me for the first 15 years of my life. When I'm thinking something's wrong, I don't know what it is, but there's something wrong. And it was an alcohol deficiency. Who knew? Because instantaneously, the fact that I am quirky and offbeat and weird and I don't fit in and I'm not right, all that went away. And if I ever went over the mark, because I sometimes do, I can kind of get a little on the weird side or, you know, made fun of somebody and somebody's feelings got hurt, well, then I could say I was just drunk, right? My friend Bob D. from Vegas says that alcohol let him out to play. Golly. It was the only thing after that time that really freed me of the bondage of self. Because I felt locked up in here. You know? There wasn't a lot. I couldn't drink every day at 15. But, I mean, believe me, the first chance I got, it just got started from there. You know? I don't want to offend the pure alcoholics in the room. But the reality is that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 18. You get a lot of people young coming in, it's all mixed up in drugs for the most part. You know, it is part and parcel for what we do. And the fact is, drugs were easier to carry. They were easier to hide. I didn't slur my words. I didn't tend to hit things with my car so much. And you couldn't smell it on me, you know. And so, I'm absolutely a real alcoholic, as described in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I am an equal opportunity drug addict. Whatever you got, I'm taking it. There was never a question of, do you want this? It was like, yes, yes, please. And there wasn't, you know, when I started on that journey, and it was very, very fast, I'd say, well, if you smoke pot, you know, that's bad. But then when you do that, you can erase the line. It's natural. I mean, you know, God-given, clearly. And then if you do cocaine or something, that's bad. And you just keep erasing the line. The doctor's opinion says, to us, the alcoholic life seems the only normal one. It's normal to just adjust yourself to where you find yourself. And so you have this girl, the way I was the girl with all the promise, the girl who's, you know, the kids that I went to school with all ended up being doctors and lawyers and having pretty good careers, and they were brilliant people, or they're college professors, and I took a total 180, you know. But I'm hanging out with lower and lower companionship in your lovely city of Cartersville, by the way, because I was living here at the time, and I'm getting high with truckers and their children. I am hanging out with everybody who has you know, been to prison and or dropped out of high school and all this kind of stuff. But because I think I'm so smart and because I can rise above, I can say, I can quit this anytime I want. You know, I can get off this train, you know. I didn't have to be like them. When I graduated from high school, I had pins and cords around my neck and all this stuff. And all I could think, my grandmother came, it was a big deal. And all I could think of was get that hot money in my little hands and run off to Panama City and blow it all. And I have the pictures to show for it, and they are not pretty. You know, I have a fantastic photo of this bad perm with red eyes and like beer cans on the table and some marijuana and all this kind of stuff. And I'm wearing a white T-shirt I had made down there that had the Coca-Cola symbol on it, the old one. And it, but it said, instead of saying enjoy Coca-Cola, it says enjoy cocaine. Like, yeah, that's who you got. I was definitely kind of a bar fly kind of drinker, except for I really was too young to get in a lot of bars, but I love to go out amongst people, do the normal things that people do, like go to movies, go to football games, absolutely slammed, hammered. So when I get sober at 18, I'm like, how do you do those things? I don't know how to do anything without being high. Because why would you do anything? Why would you go to school without being high? I mean, I couldn't tolerate people. I didn't like them, thought they were boring. I don't feel like I fit in, so I have to hate you. You know, all this kind of stuff. And I'm going off to college, which, I mean, again, I had the promise of going to some of the best colleges, and I just said, I'm just going to go to this, you know. I mean, Georgia Southern is fine. My grandmother lived there, but the only reason I went there is because she dangled a condo in front of me. I mean, clearly, I'm influenced by vanity and things that are free. And so, any of the things that I was supposed to do, and all these meetings entitled, what are we going to do about Kathy? You have so much potential. And I just went, of course I do. Yes, I have potential, and I'm sure that I'll realize that potential later, but right now I'm having a good time. I mean, it was still sort of working for me on some level, at least, but the moments of getting relief from drinking and from doing those other outside things was getting smaller and smaller, you know? And my life was spiraling out of control so quick. I really was like those guys that are spinning the plates in the air, and they're about to, the anxiety, they're going to fall any minute. You're barely holding it together. But I managed to, like, quit jobs right before they fired me, and, like, you know, so I managed to keep the consequences down to something that I thought was reasonable. I did hit 3 cars, a tree, a ditch, and a MARTA bus, so that kind of shows that I should have had multiple DUIs. I just didn't. You know, I either talked my way out of it or skated my way out of it or something. And again, I thought that was a criteria for being in AA. I mean, every alcoholic had a DUI, right? I didn't know what a blackout was till I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, because you don't tend to black out a lot when you're mixing the stuff that I do. And, you know, when I was just drinking from 15 to 16, I was like projectile vomit girl. And I've done a lot of studies of my friends in AA. I found out that you really can't do projectile vomiting on a regular basis and black out. You got to kind of keep it in for it to be all saturated, and then you lose time. But I was the person who was constantly getting violently ill because I throw the booze down. I don't know about drinking normally. I don't know about timing it, you know. It is like, get downtown now. Bring the funnel. Right? That's the kind of way I drank, right? I mean, the idea of being a normal person who goes to work all day, comes home, fixes dinner for their kids, has a glass of wine, doesn't even sound appealing today. You know, I want to have the glass of wine, screw the kids, and then let's go to Mexico. Like, that's the kind of drinker you got, you know? I don't want responsibility. I don't want any of that. I don't want to be normal. I don't get it. Feels like alcohol abuse to me. You know, so I, you know, went for one last hurrah. I'm going to college, and I got to bring a stash of my favorite things with me, and we get busted by the DEA. And to make a long story short, you know, my bank account's frozen, my car is seized in this drug bust, and everything material-wise that I could have lost, I lost that day. And this is blowing my mind, and I just am like 3 weeks past my 18th birthday. And I don't know what to do. They you know, I'm supposed to have drug tests. They got to be clean. And I thought, if you have my life, you'd have to drink and use too. I tried to switch back to go. I felt like going old school and just drinking again. But it was so messed up in this life that was very hard to turn around. And it is not. It is an abnormal reaction, which is what the definition I love of an allergy. It is an abnormal reaction to put a few beers in you or a couple of drinks and be like, I got to go to the dope man's house. I have plenty of people that can drink normally, and they might even tie one on some occasions, and they don't go to the dope man's house. Even if back in college they used to do that. You know, it was all mixed up together for me. And so I can't stay sober. I'm always getting in relationships with guys that don't do right. And I'm kind of thinking about suicide on a regular basis. And finally, you know, I have a second test that comes out dirty. I'm sure I skated by a few of them using the tricks that we do. But then you start getting really cocky, right? I got this. I'm so smart. And so the second test comes out dirty, and the judge wants me to come in so he can talk to me. Well, I'm totally paranoid. I know what this means. He wants to throw me in jail, right? And I thought, I cannot go to jail, you know? And so I ducked away to a treatment center. I thought, they're not going to get me out of a medical facility. Always staying one step ahead of the game. And the truth is, I went to Peachford Hospital in Atlanta for the 30-day stay, when that was like the normal thing in 1989. And, you know, back then, I don't know how it is now. I know we do meetings in the detox center, but they seem to be like a quick turnaround, spin dry, you know, so then we can grab them up and bring them to our home group. But back then, you had a normal 30-day stay. You went to art therapy and music therapy and did all kinds of guided imagery and this stuff. And I loved it all because I felt crazy. Carla R. from California, who just spoke at the Atlanta Roundup, talked about coming to AA, and somebody mentioned that they felt like a scream looking for a mouth. And I get it. I feel like I'm on this close to combustion at any minute. I'm crazy. And the truth is it's all because of my mother. It's all because of growing up in alcoholism. I'm an utter victim. And I felt like all this therapy was going to be good for me because I feel like somebody who needs their head shrunk. And my hope was that I could get my head shrunk, and then I could maybe even drink and party and not want to kill myself on a regular basis. You know, I remember talking on a payphone, dating myself too, back in the day to my boyfriend saying, it's not like I'm going to be sober. I had no intention of getting sober at that time. It was just to look good for the judge. I didn't want to turn around and set up people to bust them like we were, but I was afraid to like say, I'm not a rat, and be, you know. so I just ducked in there to get out of it. And then they start talking about a halfway house, and I'm like, well, you know, I got places to go. I mean, I got to get back to my life, you know. I'm missing school here, you know. You locked me up for 30 days. I think I'm done with that. And that very afternoon, I get a call from my lawyer who says, you know, they're not trying to get you for the 100 tabs of ecstasy you were buying. They're trying to get you for the full 4,000. And I went and found that counselor. What was that thing you're talking about, a halfway house? You know? again, always playing a scam, you know? When they talk about having a program of rigorous honesty, that is not something that I can go, okay, I'll just do that then. I mean, I have the most deceptive, dishonest ego. You know, it cares nothing about the truth. You know, and of course there's a lot of self-delusion, but I would lie absolutely, as Tim said, when the truth would have been just fine. But there's no torque in the truth. You know, you always got to kind of do the alcoholic math. How many drinks did you have?
Two.
That's right. We all know it, right? If you're trying to impress your buddies, how many drinks do you have? You got to multiply by two. You know, depends on what I think of you, you know. Nothing has ever dealt with the truth. And I was incapable of seeing what was really going on because I have an idea of what it means if you have a problem, what it looks like. And because I'd always worked since I was 14, I had done really well in school, all this potential, can't be an alcoholic. Impossible. But I went to the halfway house, and I went in South Georgia, and there, you know, they took me off any medication that Peachford put me on for my depression, you know, which I thought, I am depressed. I am just a sad, sad state. And, you know, I'm not going to say what anybody's situation is in here, but for me, I've been diagnosed as clinically depressed, bipolar, and manic depressive, depending on what the flavor in psychiatry was and what I brought to them that day. And I look like all that and then some. And I've been put on medications for different things. And turns out, all I've ever had is really bad alcoholism. And when I finally got on board working the steps and got out of the group later that was dying since the beginning of AA, and it says, those that can't stay sober are the ones who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the program. Stop going down the Piccadilly line at the cafeteria and picking out the bread, because that's good, and the dessert and whatever. Get everything. Get it all, right? And when I'm not a person who's doing it all, man, that depression comes back really quick, because I have the depression of the overly self-involved individual. I can't see you. You're just shadows until you come in full focus because I want something from you, or I think you don't like me, or you pop into full focus. But other than that, I don't even see you because I become locked up in here again, and I'm depressed instantaneously. But back then, Peachford put me on some stuff, and that place in South Georgia took me off of it, and they just basically gave me some speaker cassettes. I'm really dating myself. With an old cassette recorder and a big book. So all those really fancy books that I got from Peachford, like Codependent No More and like all these other things that I thought were great, and like that dusty old big book, I mean, they made you go to those AA meetings, and I was just like, oh, this is such a waste of time. Let's get back to the guided imagery session. I mean, I didn't know they were trying to save my life with those things, but it was real easy for me to go off on a therapeutic effort because I always felt like I was right on the breakthrough of something that was going to make everything right, all the pieces were going to fit together, somehow we were going to rewrite the story or fix the wiring, and then I wouldn't be so crazy. And it couldn't have been more than further from that truth. The truth was, just like Don said, I needed to get into action in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I wasn't convinced I needed to. Furthermore, I come to AA, and they made you go to a lot of AA meetings. I mean, thankfully, the magic happened when I was at that halfway house in that I fell in love with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm thinking I'm 18 years old. I'm never going to have fun again. I'm never going to laugh again. My life is over. I have to be a big, fat square, and that wasn't the case. I found a fellowship, and we used to go do things all the time. We go to conferences, which is just like pajama parties with boys, and, all the young people's things, and we were running around. It was so fun and all this stuff, and, later on, when I was able to go of my own volition, I still showed up at the meetings, but sometimes I'd make the decision of going to meetings whether the cute guy's car was in the parking lot, because there was a couple of choices of meetings, and I'd leave that sponsor at the meetings that was just a name only. Anyway, I'd leave the steps there, leave God there, take a man, a cup of coffee from the meeting. You know what I mean? I remember hearing one of the first speakers on those cassettes that somebody gave me was a woman from California who got sober at 13. And she said on there that she goes, she said, I used to fall in love at the coffee pot. And then the next meeting, they'd bring a girl there, and I felt like I was being cheated on. Like, I totally get that. I fell in love on a regular basis with guys here, And it was most of it was just in my mind. Sometimes there was some action involved with that and try to flirt or date or whatever, but most of it was just all in my mind, completely insane. But I went to this halfway house and ultimately had to go to prison. And I went to the federal penitentiary, the narcotics farm in Lexington, Kentucky, which is perfect for me. Found out later jazz musicians went there, so that was really, had a little bit of panache to it, it's just because they didn't know what else to do with you, they just put you in prison. Tried to give you some help, but, we got locked away, before there were treatment centers. So I did my time, and when I got out, I guess the only significant thing about that really was that I had the opportunity to drink homemade alcohol there that they fermented in the walls. Hooch, in my ego and the spirit, I mean, I really believe in my life that I am at the center of this ultimate tug of war. This is the problem between the spirit on one end and the ego here, and it's just tug and pull constantly, even today, right? And as my friend Bob says, which one wins? The one you feed, the one you help, But it's constantly doing this, and people always said it's like the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other, you know. I think devil's another word for ego, personally. And so it's like, don't do it, don't drink that homemade alcohol, no, you know. And the other one's like, oh, it'll be fine, nobody will know, you can just go back to back home when you get out and pick up your one-year chip because you'll be close to having a year and it'll be great, nobody will know. I mean, that voice has always been there, clearly. If I can come to AA years later and be not sober, you know what I mean? Just one little bit that I had learned there. I thought, you know, what if the people in AA are right and you're never going to be happy doing this over and over again? And just that was enough on a shred of a hope that you might have been telling me the truth, because I wasn't really sure most of the time, because I always thought my case was different. I'm a very complex person. I feel like I need a team of people looking after me all the time. Just this fuddy-duddy AA just ain't enough, you know what I mean? Like, I am really off the beam. But I made that choice, and I did go back and get my one-year chip sober. And that it was really when I made the active choice to become kind of a more active, I guess, on some level, at least in my heart, member of AA. Like, I'm going to do this deal. But again, I don't really believe step one, so, you know, it's like you're giving me a treatment for a bum knee when it's really my elbow that's hurting. I'm not going to take your treatment if I don't think I need to. And so I came to meetings, and I stayed sober for 4 years just on the fellowship of doing all those activities and having a good time. And the treatment center would say things like, you change your playmates, your playgrounds, and your playthings. I did all those. Well, I mean, when I got busted, it was like, turn on the light, the roaches scatter. I mean, my friends were like gone. I was like kryptonite, you know. They don't want anything to do with me with this humongous drug bust that's in the newspapers and all this stuff, you know. So I made a life in the fellowship of AA. But I never was concerned with who's making that coffee, who's setting up those chairs. I don't know. I usually went to clubhouses, and all that stuff was already done for you anyway, it seemed. I thought that the traditions just applied to those people doing, like, you know, the treasurer and the secretary, like, you know, it was like in the Peanuts, like, wah, 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 you know, the thing that you know, if there were cell phones back in that day, I would have been texting, like, sexting somebody across the room, probably. thank God there weren't cell phones back in that day. Oh my God, thank God there weren't cell phones and social media when I was drinking. I shudder at the thought of the stuff that I would have put out there that I could never get back again. My heart's out to you if you're new and have done the drunk social media postings. It's worse than drunk dialing, I think. So it was fine for a while because I get a relationship from one of these coffee pot romances, and I'm having a good time. I go to school. I'm always been a fairly driven. I mean, so funny. I'm driven on one level and really lazy on the other. Again, double personality. You know, it just depends. But I finished college in 3 years because I'm motivated. I want to get out. But somewhere between the year 3 and 4, the fact that I am coming to AA, which, by the way, is insane to join a 12-step program and not work 12 steps. There's something wrong with this, right? But because I basically came to AA meetings. We would talk about the steps. I went to step meetings. We'd talk about the steps and philosophize. And, you know, my husband and I talk about going to like a 11 o'clock in the morning meeting. You hear some great thing from somebody, something very profound, and then you go share it at 5:30 like it's your own, you know? And people come up to you and go, that really helped me. You know, you go, keep coming back. It works, you know? And you just, again, a pretend AA member. You become a pretend person. I am a quick study. I come to AA and I have no God at all. I don't even know the Lord's Prayer because we never went to church. Only times I ever went to a church because I spent the night with somebody on Saturday night. I went with their family the next day. So I've heard the Lord's Prayer, but I don't know it. By day third meeting, I got it, right? Because I'm a quick study. But I'm a pretend AA person. I don't know about you, but did you ever go to the bar, sit next to somebody who was getting hammered and get drunk? No, you have to do what they're doing to get drunk. You have to drink right alongside them. So I was not going to get the light that I saw in your eyes, get a relationship with God, be useful, happy, comfortable, by just sitting next to you. You know? It doesn't happen that way. You have to do the same thing as everybody is doing. But I also chose the meetings where they weren't talking a lot about the steps, and not in a real way, just philosophizing, you know, mostly sharing about what was happening that day. And it was like group therapy. It's like talk therapy. You know, and you leave the meeting feeling better because you spouted off your stuff, and so you brought that pressure cooker down a little bit. But there's no real solution in that. I needed to get in action, and I didn't know. And so between year 3 and 4, that depression comes back bad, right? Coupled with the fact that I have an amazing gift of time travel. I don't know if you guys do this, but, I believe that the acronym for ego is easing God out. And I believe that just as Don was talking about what can happen in the next 5 minutes, I believe that the only place that God lives is in the present. The presence of God. Like, right now. Not even 10 minutes ago. Like, right now. That's all that really exists. But my ego is constantly trying to time travel me and pull me away from the present time. And what that looks like is I either go back to the past and I replay stuff, resentment, and I play it over and over again. When I should have said this and then this kind of thing, and I'm just spinning about that. Or I'm beating the crap out of myself with remorse. You should have taken that left turn at Albuquerque. You know what I mean? Like, and I won't let it go. You know? Or, and I thankfully when I time travel, there's a lot less of that because of the work I have done in AA. But going forward, and this is where I tend to go now, even now, I go forward in the future, and it's always one of two things. It's either everything coming at me is terrifying, like Chicken Little. The sky is going to fall any minute. Or I'll be happy when, you know, like I know it's bad now, but I'll be happy when I get the boyfriend or the house or the money and the thing and the whatever it is, it's just not the present circumstances. But it maybe gives me some sort of hope for another day. So sobriety started looking like checking off days. And I know what it's like to do time. And it's miserable when you come to AA and you're suffering from untreated alcoholism because you're not willing to completely give yourself to the deal. I would rather be drinking, quite frankly, because at least I'll get a little bit of relief. There's a lot of people with a lot of time sober that their ego won't allow them to drink again, suffering for a long time from untreated alcoholism, but they'll put a bullet in their brain. But at least they died sober. Wow, right? But I was just... I had the, is this all there is to sobriety syndrome? I thought, if that woman cries one more time in the meeting, I'm going to punch her right in the face. And that guy's a 13th stepper. He's just a sleazebag. And that person doesn't put any money in the basket. And this kind of thing. You know, I mean, I just was eat up, you know? And it felt like there's nothing new here in AA. My mind's not being blown anymore, right? And I'm becoming useless. You know, I believe the line in the promises that they say, that feeling, one feeling, of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Self-pity is just a fancy word for depression. They just don't write you a script for self-pity. Right? So if I'm full of self-pity and depression, what's the answer? Be useful. Right? That is what has solved my depression problem. Be useful. But I didn't know that then. And I just thought, if I could just get out of college, if I could just get out of South Georgia, if I could just be back in Atlanta, and if I could just get a job with 2 felonies, it's all going to come together, right? And I held on by my fingernails, and God was very gracious because I got a job with felonies. I got a cute little apartment in Atlanta. Didn't have the boyfriend yet, but was kind of thrilled with this new job, and like I'm on my own, all this kind of stuff is great, and I was drunk a week later. I had just picked up a 4-year chip. Because what is wrong with me was not caused by my outside circumstances, not even my childhood. And it cannot be fixed by outside circumstances. It is all inside. And I didn't know that. And I had the looking in the mirror and going, I don't know who you think you're fooling, but you're the same old girl you have always been, who is no good, who doesn't has to be extra special just to be average. You know what I mean? Always thinking you are extra special or they should be treating you that way, but secretly knowing that's not true. You know, and I it was probably significant in that I just drank. I was still on probation. I was really afraid of going back to prison and having a dirty test. And I was over 21, so I really wasn't committing a crime at that time. But man, did I see just the drinking and how crazy I was. I'd be obsessing about it at work and going, okay, if I get a six-pack on the way home, maybe an alcoholic. I mean, AA messes up your drinking bad, right? And I'm just like going, okay, well, you know, and at first it was like, I don't have the experience that some people do about going back out and immediately picking up where you were. I am strong-willed. And I set out to prove to you that's not true. The minute that my ego goes, see, it was just a phase. You were young. And you know, because you got into the drugs, that was really the problem. You know, alcohol is fine if you just stick with this. The minute that I thought I got this, here comes the projectile vomiting. Here comes, I'm taking the beer and I'm stealing yours and all the stuff. I'm trying to drive to the store more and I'm hammered. It happens very fast. And I did not think I was going to walk back into Alcoholics Anonymous when I did. My girlfriend from South Georgia came to see me. I had not drank that day. Within 5 minutes of talking to me, she goes, "You've been drinking, haven't you? You're like, you've relapsed." The whole demeanor of a person changes if you watch, if you're conscious of it. And I admitted it. And, you know, we talked that weekend. On Sunday, she said, "Well, you want to go to a meeting? I'd like to go to a meeting." So I kind of went with her because she said she wanted to go. And at the end, they said, "Are there any burning desires?" Which I always have some crass comment for that means you need some cream down there. But I raised my hand, you know, and I said, I picked up a four-year chip here a couple months ago and drank the week after, you know. And I don't know if I really want what you have. I know I don't want what I had when I was coming here, you know. And I'm not an idiot. It didn't take long for me to sit home going, why did you do that? Why did that happen? Well, because you had a sponsor in name only. You would see her at the meetings and tell her about what happened that day or last week or whatever. Not calling when you needed to. Never calling, really. Just seeing them at the meeting, checking in, giving them yesterday's news. You didn't use a sponsor. You did never work the steps. You graduated from total atheism to agnosticism and just stopped there because you weren't willing to do the steps. You know, I came in a diehard atheist, as they describe in the book, except for I'm way too lazy to read books like from Nietzsche and stuff like that. I just knew that there wasn't one, and that's it. And I would listen to people's stories, and I would be right with them when they would talk about their experiences and the funny stories and the tragic things and how they felt, and I'm right with them. And then they talk about what happened when they came to AA and finding God, and I go, see, now you're stupid. I just shut down everything that I got from you. And I thought in order to get God here that I was going to have to dumb myself down and believe in the Easter Bunny. That's how the kind of arrogant person I was. I would never tell you that because I'm a pretend person. I want you to like me. But in my mind, I'm judging the crap out of you, you know. And so I realized that the reason you don't have a God in your life is perhaps because you never worked the steps. You avoided big book meetings like the plague. You have a big book you got from that hospital 4 years ago, but it still was like crack with the binder because you never opened it, you know? You went to step meetings thinking the steps are there, so why do you need that old book? So there's it's pretty easy to see some things you need to do. So I started going to a big book study. I got a sponsor that I started working with. Sorry, I keep trying to check and see how the time's going. My sponsor said, come over once a week. We're going to go through the big book. And when it says to write, we're going to write. And when it says to pray, we're going to pray. I'm not going to have you write about step one or write about step two or anything the book says. Not to do. I mean, it doesn't say to do that. That's treatment center stuff, whatever. We're going to do exactly what it says here. And I said, okay. So I showed up the first time, and she said, let's go to the beginning of the book. So I go to page one, which is Bill's story. She goes, no, the beginning. Oh, my God. Now we're in the Roman numeral pages of doctor's opinion stuff. Like, really? Nobody reads that. I don't read any books, by the way. I just skim or call somebody and go, what was that book about? And then write a paper because I'm a cheat. I want the easier, softer way always. And so finally she says this several times. And I'm thinking, okay, there's a catch to this, you know. So finally I'm at the beginning of the book where it's just like the cover inside. There's nothing written on these two pages. This is where you write your sobriety date. And like me, you mark through it and change it if need be. And she goes, what do you see there? I said, nothing. She goes, great. That's what you know about staying sober. Nothing. I immediately thought, I have the wrong sponsor. Because she's supposed to see how amazingly brilliant smart I am. And she's just like totally slamming me to the mat first meeting. But whatever. I mean, it's funny how a good sponsor, one that you connect with, can say, and they could take your inventory up and down. And you just take it. And you go, you know, you're right. I mean, they said, you're completely insane or whatever. And I go, yeah, that's right. If my family had said that, I'd have been like fighting mad, right? And a sponsor could get away with saying a lot of things to me. And I took the direction because I was really desperate. I didn't want to stay in AA. I knew I needed to be in AA, and I loved AA, and I knew there was a solution here. But I wasn't going to get it through osmosis. I had to do some stuff. And so we worked the steps together. And lo and behold, I mean, at 3 months when I got that chip, I was crying through the meeting because my ego's still taking a beating. By 6 months, I'm on top of the world. It doesn't have to take forever if you're willing to just get in here and do it. Get busy, right? And I did have that beautiful thing the doctor's opinion talks about, which is a psychic change. You know, I started looking at things differently. I still today have every single defect I ever came in with. A lot of them are a lot more dormant. They don't tend to pop up very often. I mean, I stopped being the shoplifter, five-finger discount girl just because I got sober at 18. I mean, I did no step work or anything. I just stopped. Amazing. But, you know, other things are still there. They just pop up occasionally. But I started looking at life differently, looking at things differently, got through a fourth and fifth step, and it got to the point of making some real amends. And what that looked like with my father was really important because the first few years when I'm doing all this family of origin work, geez Louise, I would sometimes get in these conversations with my father, which basically is, and this kind of goes into the four step as well, is that, you know, even back then I was taught that there was a four-column resentment inventory as part of the four step, and then in the fourth column you're looking for your part. I don't believe that at all today because the book says you're disregarding them entirely. You're looking 100% at you. There is no more parts. You've already written all that down. Now it's you standing alone because I came into AA the first time with no guilt whatsoever. I could have easily been considered a sociopath. When you're talking about the ego being a sociopath, I understand that because I didn't feel guilty because I always hid behind your bad behavior. I wouldn't have been like that if you hadn't have done that. And if I didn't have anything to hang it on, well, I wouldn't have been like that if I hadn't grown up in that crazy childhood. I always, because you and my mother as the ace in the hole, right? So it excused everything. I have friends that came in, and most of them were pretty religious. So being an atheist, you don't have to worry about that pesky guilt, apparently, because I didn't feel guilty for anything I had ever done. I grew a conscience in Alcoholics Anonymous as I grew a relationship with God. You know, and so I was able to do a four-step and see my father in a different light where I thought, you're the man who worked two jobs, stayed away from the house, and left me with that alcoholic witch. You know, you never cared about me. You know, I'd make straight A's and I didn't get the right response. It was like you just expected it. Whatever, you know. I saw it totally different. You know, what I saw after I really did a fourth and fifth step was, how do you think it must have felt for that man every night when he didn't know where you were? You know, look at those bags under his eyes. You think you might have put some of that there? Think about his wife who hit him in the head with a hammer in a blackout, and then his only daughter, the one that had so much promise, did the same thing, going down the same path. How do you think that felt for him? And he's a good guy, actually. Pretty practical, simple guy, lived in here in Cartersville, you know? And how do you think it must have felt to drop off his only daughter at 18 years old at that big, imposing prison in Kentucky? Say, bye, see you in 6 months, and leave. I never once thought about that man at that time. All I thought about is, I'm going to be raped, I'm going to be beaten, I'm going to be blah, 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 blah. It was all about me. I mean, and I just dropped my son off at college yesterday. And I just said, I'll see you in 2 weeks. And I felt like, oh my God, is he going to be okay? I can't imagine what that man must have felt. And so I believe that my amends have gone so much better when I get it from their side. What it must have felt like to have had done to them what I did. Those are when the amends go really well because you get it. It's not just saying I stole and I'm sorry I lied and I'm sorry I cheated on it. You know, it's about getting their position. Finally being able to see it. As if I'm in their shoes. And before, I would have given anything for him to say, you know, I really wasn't the best father and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I'd be like, yeah, but that's okay, Dad. You know, that was the response I wanted when I did all that therapy, right? And he wasn't taking the bite. And we got in a lot of fights, even with multiple years of sobriety, where I stormed out of his house and left. You know, when I made that amends at a little over a year sober to him, he finally said the thing I wanted him to say, which was, you know I made a lot of mistakes as your dad. And I said, Dad, you were great. You were perfect. You know, I didn't want to hear anything he had to say, really. I took him off the hook because maybe on some level he felt responsible for what happened on some level if he hadn't taken that left turn at Albuquerque. And I was like, no, you did a great job, you know. And we were really, really good and got better and better through the years until he died 2 years ago. And it was healed, which was great. That's a gift I'll never be able to repay to Alcoholics Anonymous. But here's the thing about a psychic change. It's not permanent without your cooperation. You can psychic change back to what you were or something that's even less prettier than what you were, which is what I did. I don't know exactly when that started happening. Maybe around 4 or 5 years sobriety. I don't know exactly, really. But I do know that I got married to a member of AA, which was great, to my best friend. We started moving for him to go to graduate school. And it's hard to move as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Yes, you can find AA at most of your destinations, but they never do it right anywhere you go. They never do it right. And everywhere we've moved, we'd end up starting up a home group, so that says a lot about what we think about the AA in that area. Still, to this day. And I was a victim of this. I mean, there's a lot of things that aren't necessarily true that you hear in meetings all the time, like the looking for your part in the four step. And you'd accept it as common verbiage, but that's not what the book says. You know, one of the things I heard was whenever you move, you got to get a sponsor in the new place you move. That's not necessarily true. Great idea. And sometimes somebody will come present it yourself. You can learn a new experience. It's great. But if you can't find that, you can't be sponsored long distance. I currently have a sponsor who lives in Virginia. And so it's possible. There are phones. I mean, you know, we don't have to put it on the back of a horse and, like, you know, I mean, you can get in touch with people pretty quickly now. But I never could seem to find the right sponsor or, you know, whatever. And so in no time, I'm being sponsored by an idiot, me. Right? So I'm bouncing my own anger, my own martyrdom. Why am I the person who has to do everything around here? Nobody does anything right. You know, I'm irritated. I'm fearful. All these things that we're guaranteed to be at times. We are going to get disturbed. I love Sandy Beach for saying, the game we play is the least disturbed person in the room wins. And when I'm disturbed, I need to call my sponsor. I need to pray. But what I'm doing is bouncing it off my own mind and thinking, oh, it's really not that big a deal. We'll just brush that one under the rug. Well, pretty soon, you've got a rug that looks like this, you know, and you're trying to go around the rug in the room. And there were plenty of days in England, we lived in England for 4 years, that my husband would work, go to work, working on his PhD, working hard, come home and have to literally put his hand near the door to feel the temperature gauge. What's it going to be like? What am I going to walk into? Is she going to be screaming her head off at these two little boys that are driving her crazy? She going to be in the corner crying, blubbering because I can't do it. I can't do it one more second. I mean, I am like a raw nerve. Or is it going to be fine? I mean, you just never knew, right? I am suffering again from untreated alcoholism, and I am sponsoring multiple people. We have a home group. I'm doing more, and it's not enough because I'm not being sponsored. It's not current. And my ego is taken over. I can't stay one step ahead of it. It is completely coming on over the top. And again, I time travel thinking if I can just get back in Atlanta, you know, everything's going to be fine. And I came back with 7 years sober, and it wasn't fine. I had been running the show so long in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't see land, and I couldn't, you know, humble my ego enough to say, I'm dying here. I need to start over as a member of AA. I really love when people do that with multiple years and they say, I've just been doing this all wrong. And they go at this like a child, like a newcomer, and have a new experience and start over. I'm the idiot that has to drink again before I'm willing to do it. But I held on by my fingernails. You know, and just because you get sober, hate to tell this to the newcomers, doesn't mean your life's going to be a bowl of cherries. Life does not start happening. I don't believe that's part of God's plan. I don't believe God's planning these things for me. I don't put God in that kind of place. That's not my relationship with God. But I believe God can make lemonade out of lemons. But those lemons are coming at you sometimes. And sometimes they come in like big ones, like crates of them on top of you. You know, and God will show me a day at a time how to respond. What is your will for me? This thing is blowing my mind. How do I respond? But I wasn't doing any of that. And the bad luck floats around. It's going to land on somebody. And it landed on us. And at 10 years sober, stark raving sober, dry as could be, my grandmother, who was like my mother, she was my maternal grandmother, fell and broke her hip. And that started a year and a half long demise till she passed away. While I'm in the hospital, I have had to deliver my daughter by emergency C-section. She's had a stroke in the womb. I get the news about my grandmother while I'm there. She's at the children's hospital. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if this child's going to ever eat or walk or talk or do anything. You know? And the truth is, I think, I don't really believe God does that. You know, that's not my relationship. But there were times when I laid there and I thought, of course this happened to you. You deserve this. Think about how awful you have been to those boys. Screaming at them. Sometimes hitting them. Just cannot handle it. I mean, I was sure that I was going to be the topic of but topic of a psychiatrist conversation entitled My Mother Ruined My Life, because that's what I did. You know, I just assumed that was the same thing. You know, you repeat the same mistakes again. And I thought, this is going to be, I'm ruining them. So of course you have a special needs child you can't take care of, who may die. You know, it seemed like perfect. I mean, I wasn't even sad about it. I wasn't angry, rather, with God or anything. I was like, of course, it makes perfect sense to me. I mean, if I was God, I would totally do that stuff to people. You know what I mean? It's a good thing God's not like me. Because, and this is one of the things that's funny, when I didn't have a God in my life, and people would say, and I hear it still sometimes, and whatever works for you is fine, but I hear sometimes people say, you know, you could choose your own conception. Get out a piece of paper and write down what your conception of God would be, and then just start praying to that, even if you don't believe it or whatever. I could never get on board with those types of intellectual exercises. Gratitude lists, yeah. I've never had a lot of success with them because I'm not an idiot. I can make a gratitude list right now. I'm grateful for my health and for my boys and my family and my this and that. But when I'm not feeling grateful and I look at that list and I should upon myself. I should feel grateful for this and I should feel grateful for that, but I don't. Right? It's better that I act like a grateful person and then I might get to feel like that sometimes. You know? And so making this, I mean, my idea of God, if I had just created the conception, today would be the same as it was at 18. It's like a cross between Santa Claus that would give me everything that I asked for, including, I'm not a selfish person. I mean, cure Amy's cancer and, you know, stuff like that, you know, but give me the nice car and a good man. So it's Santa Claus. And then other half of it is like this 13-story wizard with this zapper, and the bad people would just get zapped, right? I mean, you know, really, really bad people might be dead. But other than that, you know, you might get the special needs child, or you might have a flat tire or whatever. I get a flat tire, I'd be like, why are you doing this to me? As if God has zapped me with the zapper, right? I'd still have that kind of God. I mean, my friends and I talk about putting on the capes of justice. We like to put on the justice capes and go fight the injustices in the world. Like, you know, it's still really silly. I mean, God's only there for power. These lights, this power, and here doesn't care if I have a special needs child. Doesn't care if I get a flat tire. Didn't have anything to do with it. If I paid my light bill, I have absolute faith and trust. If I switch, put that switch on, it'll be there. Just that simple. And it's on a dimmer switch, which is really cool. The more that I get ahead of my bills and put more into it, the brighter it gets. Just that simple. I never have to put God in the chump position of blessing me or cursing me or whatever. It's just power. And I've been a person who's been dying on this planet looking for power on everywhere on the planet I could find it. Drugs and alcohol were a huge power greater than me. So was men. That's my first drug. I've been chasing little boys around the room when I was 5 years old. Money, looking good, sounding good, making good grades, feeling smarter than everybody. There's all kinds of forms of power. And I'm misinterpreting the vacancy inside of me. That hole in the soul we talk about is a God-shaped hole, period. But there's a lot of things that feel like it fills it up for a minute. And I exhausted all of those. And a lot of that I did in sobriety. I watched people do that. And the problem is the second half of the first step. They may have said they're powerless over alcohol, but is their life really unmanageable by them? And we throw the money and the jobs and the things on top of it. And it, at some point, you have a second surrender, hopefully, in AA, where you're like, I can't, I'm a failure at managing my own life. You know, none of that power is ever really going to do the job. So, you know, I'm feeling pretty low because all this stuff's happened. It causes me a lot of worry. And the first chance I get, I'm healthy enough after a C-section to go down to South Georgia to visit my grandmother. I start looking in her cabinets. Because I'm a snoop, by the way. I used to do the old school stalking, you know, when you drive by somebody's house or you call and hang up on them, you know. You can actually stalk people better with cell phone stuff these days, but I snoop through the cabinets. Why people leave painkillers and stuff laying around for somebody like me to steal from you, I don't even know. So I took one and I kicked back. My daughter was in bed. I watched TV and nothing happened. I just felt a little good and I opened a door. 2 years later, after picking up year 11 and year 12 chips and wasn't sober, I was using 25 a day, round the clock, withdrawing in the middle of the night. And that's the thing with those kinds of, I mean, there's a lot of good AA members for legit, now this was, I was taking it for not legitimate reasons, right? It's not like I had a surgery and then got, but we lose a lot of people in AA from taking things like that, that aren't mindful of it, aren't protecting their sobriety and using some tools we have here to protect themselves over something that's very powerful. And they may not have had a drug problem before, and all of a sudden they got one. It's taken a lot of people out the door, you know. But mine was just because not only does it help physical pain, it cures all pain. And I could have walked out of my house with these kids driving me crazy, my husband doesn't love me right, and this kind of thing, and all this stuff. And I could have left. And all of a sudden I'm taking these painkillers, and I can stay. And I feel like Superwoman. I could clean the bathroom at 1 a.m., you know. But eventually, I got really tired, you know, and I could have kept it going for a little longer or whatever, but I was really tired, and, you know, we have these moments of clarity that are really narrow, and there's a lot of times you could think, I remember having that, and you didn't take the opportunity. It closes really fast, right? But I was having that moment of clarity, and I was going to play a scam and maybe come off of them and fake having the flu so I could still get my 13-year chip. But there was that moment of clarity, that sick feeling. And I remembered this speaker I'd heard one time when we lived in England, and I can't remember really anything she said except for one line. And forgive me for the cursing. But what she said was, sometimes you can't save your ass and your face at the same time. And it was more important that I save my ass at that moment rather than keep my AA trophies and risk the friends I was going to lose and things like that. And there was a lot of that going on. But I sat my husband down on January 4th and told him what had been going on, you know, and started back again. When I came into AA at 18, you know, I had a pink cloud when I realized there were great people here and all this kind of stuff, and I was having fun in AA as a young person. And when I came in the second time, when I started working the steps out of the big book, I kind of had a second pink cloud because, okay, here's the answer, right? The third time, no pink cloud. This is why it's so hard for people with double-digit sobriety to get back here. My alcoholism had progressed that entire time. And what had progressed? The ego. I had an ego deflation at depth. I had to stand in front of my home group that very night that I told my husband that afternoon what had been going on and step down as group chairperson. Because, see, I was group chairperson. I'd taken people to the big book, been asked to speak places. I had to stand up and tell them what I did. A lot of times, people aren't successful when they come back in. If they had any kind of time and connection to AA, they want to slink off to a meeting nobody knows them at and protect that ego. And I knew that that wasn't going to happen, so I had to stand up naked, basically, and say, I've been a complete liar. I have taken from you. I've taken the spirituality and the camaraderie and the fellowship and all this stuff and then pop pills in your bathroom. You know, and I've been a complete fraud, you know, And it took a long time. I mean, I was in a total depression for that first year. Just, I'm part of it's detox, I'm sure, but part of it was just there was nothing new here. What I was going to have to do was what you would learn to do before and crawl one day at a time out of that long hole. Because nobody's going to ask you to sponsor them with 2 months, you know? And you're just going to have to sit a lot with this and pray and go to the meetings and just, you know. I couldn't use my sponsees or whatever to get out of it. He was like, you know. Thankfully, at almost about 10 or 11 months, I heard a speaker, my friend Bob from Vegas, in a big book weekend that he did on CD. And it changed me. It explained a lot of things that I couldn't otherwise account. Number one, I am the girl who always drinks again. And I understand that is a default position, and I always will. No matter what I've learned here, no matter what I've done here, it's got to be current. You know, I got to stay very, very in the middle of the bed and very active. I don't get a choice of whether to go to the meeting. You go. You know, I stop drawing lines in the sand, using my kids as an excuse why I can't get here, why I can't get there. I mean, I believe in keeping my first commitment. Sometimes my kids' performances do come first, and I have to miss my home group. But most of the time, I'm there. You know, I understood more about the ego, which is the real enemy here. That thing that's constantly whispering to me, you know, and about going to God for every single thing I need, including the honesty that I clearly have a problem with. And, you know, one of the things in that period of time during the 10 years that would be, you know, kind of one of my downfalls was every time we were in a meeting where they were talking about step 11, I'd always say, this is the weakest part of my program. I'm not a morning person. You know, and I would make starts on getting up early and saying, you know, doing the upon awakening and reading those, and then at night doing the nightly 11th inventory, and I would make a good start. But I'm a great starter and a terrible finisher, and I'm not good with maintenance, and I'm not good with long-term. Perseverance is a bad word. And so I had to start doing that. And the truth is, here's why I started finally doing it after 18 years of saying, this is the weakest part of my program. It's because my sponsor said, you know what? You've been a hypocrite most of your sobriety. And if you don't want to do step 11, you tell everybody you sponsor they don't have to do it. Because you can't tell them to do anything you're not currently doing. So because I cared more about you than I clearly about myself, I started getting up and doing it. And there was a line in there that said, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. That kind of assumes you have a pause button. Now, I am a brainstorm, as they talk about in the book. I am a rager. I can go from zero to rage in 1.5 seconds. I have tips of knives in cutting boards to prove it. Ah, you know, I mean, mad when I get pushed to that point. It doesn't take long, right? And I basically started doing that and asking for the power to pause, and it started showing up. And at the same time, I started getting more sponsees that have saved me from myself. They really do. I don't know often what I do for them. You know what I mean? But I know that there have been times when I needed that power to pause and I asked for it, and the phone would ring. And it'd be some sponsee talking about some stupid something. And I go outside and talk to them for five, to my children, I'll be right back, I'm going to search you out. And I go outside and talk to my sponsee and come back in. It was like it'd been brought down, you know. I'm really, really grateful to AA. I never, as Tim said, I'll never be able to really repay the debt for what I've gotten here. The friendships, the usefulness, the life of purpose. You know, and I've been able to, you know, what it looks like today for me really is, like I said, I have all the defects I ever came in with. Most of them aren't driving me crazy or other people most of the time. They do come up, and I have to take care of that. I mean, all I could do is make amends where I've overstepped it. I ask God to remove it if God sees fit and hope that it doesn't take long. But sometimes I've been having to suffer with things longer than I thought was necessary. Not really fair. Just show up, really. Show up consistently and not give myself a bit of wiggle room to wiggle out of AA commitments or what I have to do here. It doesn't matter if I want to do it. I don't want to do half the stuff I do. Maybe three quarters. But I do it anyway. I try not to complain about it the whole time because that takes a lot of that out of it, too. I might complain to my husband or somebody close, like, oh, I don't want to go, but just go, you know. you know, and my kids are doing fine, and my son went to college yesterday, and the boy that I had to homeschool, he's had a lot of problems with peers and getting in fights and being kicked out of schools and all this stuff, and I worry about how he's going to do. I worry that he's going to beat the crap out of his roommate, you know. I mean, he just lost a job a few months ago, pushed his boss down at Chick-fil-A and kicked a milkshake on him. I mean, you know, he's a product of us, right? So that's what you get. And I worry about him. And I thought I would be the topic of a psychiatrist conversation. And yet, he texted me last night and let me know what was going on. If he got in a car accident, guess who he calls? Mom. The rageaholic. You know, my daughter who has special needs, and she is the bright spot in our life. She's been a miracle. She's a joy. God's given me every single thing I need to take care of those kids. Not very well sometimes, but what I need. And I'm really grateful for my life. It's better than I ever could have imagined. And I'll leave you with this. Bob taught me this little prayer. It's not in the big book. Most of my stuff comes straight from the big book. I have an AA God for sure. But it's a little prayer that I like to leave with because it's really nice. I say it a lot. And it's called I Am the Place. It's I am the place where God shines through. He and I are one, not two. I need not fret, worry, or plan. God wants me where and as I am. And if I will be relaxed and free, he will carry out his plan through me. Thanks for listening.